Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers. The show gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host and wonderful friend, Mr. Spencer Williams. Ha!
Thank you.
See? And he didn't get eaten by an alien. Also nope. With us is intern slash Colonel Marine... Space Marine, Amy, because you got upset last week. You're like, oh, I'm not even at a something pool or whatever. And you got all sad. So I'm trying to incorporate you in this one. Just take it.
Colonel Marine?
You're a Colonel Marine now. That sounds like a promotion demotion.
It sounds like it's written. Yeah, it sounds like that, but it also sounds like it's written on duct tape on my shirt.
More than likely. We got a great show in store as we are going to be talking about the recently dropped film in the long-awaited franchise that has been on since the early 70s, and that is Alien Romulus. So stick around as we dive into that, give our thoughts, and let you know how we felt about it, and does it meet the bar? So, but before we do any of that, Spencer, give us them opening credits.
Tune in to brand new episodes each and every so often.
Wednesday.
Whenever.
On all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. You already said that.
There you go. That's right. We got a website. We got two websites, actually. We got filmlosophers.com and filmlosopherspodcast.com. There you can check out all of our...
learning information?
What?
Why do we have two?
Well, we've had the original one, and then we have the new one that we're going to be migrating over to, hopefully, fully. But yeah, we got our websites. Head on over to those websites so you can catch over allegedly 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, aliens, all that good stuff. Head on over there to listen in. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart, or Amazon Music. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or a subscribe and listen in. If you like what you hear, give us a follow. And then if you also like what you hear, give us a 5-star review because we've earned it.
We really have.
I'm doing verbal gymnastics right now. We'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. We have a fun episode ahead of us as we're going to be talking about the recently dropped Fede Alvarez film, Alien Romulus, and all of us here are huge Alien fans, both in the general sense of the movie genre as well as the specific franchise fan sense. So, but before we dive into that, it's interesting that it seems like, is it just me or is our childhood becoming more and more the common theme for most films nowadays?
It is, but the answer is not great.
Because we were talking before we went on the air, and there's apparently a film starring Jaden Martell and what is the boy's name?
You mean Ricky Baker?
Well, he has a name.
Russell from Deadpool 2.
Again, still the has actor name. Has a name.
I know. I didn't.
I think it's something Dennison or I forget. As well as the girl from the recent Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes.
And the upcoming Snow White movie.
And the upcoming Snow White movie. That's right. Something Gomez.
Julian Dennison.
Yes.
Julian Dennison. Okay.
I just pulled it up too.
And then what was her name?
Rachel
Zegler.
There you go.
That's right. And the movie is aptly called and about, in a fictional sort of way, the Y2K. And obviously if you are, you know, not older than 24, you probably have no idea what the Y2K is, or what the Y2K situation was, or obviously you didn't live through it. And us three lived through it, And it's funny that they're making movies about it, even though at the time it was a very, very serious thing for a lot of our families. And it's ultimately turned into a Maximum Overdrive parody, in my opinion, where the Y2K actually ends up happening at the stroke of midnight, and all the electronic devices turn on humanity, which was what everybody thought was going to happen at close to midnight in December 31st, 1999. It's just interesting that, like, the more and more I keep watching trailers that are coming out, the more and more, like, it just seems like they're pulling from our childhood and things like that. And I don't necessarily see that as 100% a bad thing, but I do find it more and more aware. Is it just that we're becoming more and more aware of it? Or
no, the answer is we're old now.
No.
Yes, it is, because here's why. Okay. Because if you remember 20 years ago when I was still in high school, they released a movie called Starsky and Hutch, which based on a TV show from 20 years prior, which would have been when my, like, parents were
in
high school.
But nobody even watched that one.
I don't know that. I don't know. I wasn't there. Maybe nobody watched it. Maybe everybody watched it.
Owen Wilson and
oh, are you talking about the movie?
I saw the movie. You did.
I didn't see the movie.
I didn't see the. So it makes one of us.
Right. I just, okay. Maybe it's just that it's the fact that we live through a generation where more things happen to us than I personally think any other generation. I mean, if you're looking through all of it, why are you giving me that face? I mean,
more things? There's lots of generations that had different things happening.
I think.
But did they have as much as we did?
There was one that went through a world war, maybe two, if you're
right. We went through Desert Storm. We went through 9/11. We went through Y2K. We went through Iraqi war.
That one is a war.
Yeah.
It's a world one.
It had the world in it. We went through the housing market crash. We went through a recession. We went through two pandemics, a quarantine.
We didn't even talk about, like, the stuff that, you know, all of the technological advances they're in, of us piggybacking off the late 80s and being like, this is for us now. We do the things. I mean, I had it in our house.
We lived through Scott Stapp, dang it. You know how many times I watched him on late night TV and I was like, that's a good guy. The lead singer from Creed.
Why do you know his name?
Because he's notorious. Do you not know about Scott Stapp?
No.
So, hey. All right. So,
sorry.
During the times in the late 90s, early 2000s, when there were, like, late night man TV shows.
And those infomercials we used to watch with the musical collection.
Or those infomercials that used to be on where they sold knives.
Oh, yeah.
I remember those. And then I've never felt dated until I saw that episode of Futurama where they did the Lord of the Rings parody and Smeagol bought a knife off of that. But no, so Scott Stapp, who at the time was known for his faith and whatnot within his musical career. Obviously, if you know Creed's been around for a while. But he was also known for another thing, and that was being a seriously heavy drinker. And he did one of those shows one night where he got so hammered that he was literally stumbling around the set. He was grabbing onto girls. He was like, he was a hot mess to the fullest. And it was around then when Creed decided, I think, to part ways, and ultimately just part ways with Scott Stapp. Like, Scott Stapp left. And they're like, all right, cool. And then they went and did, what was it? Something Bridge or?
What?
Their new band, the band.
Oh, Alter Bridge?
Alter Bridge. There you go.
I'm looking it up.
Yeah. And apparently Scott got cleaned up and whatever. And almost 20 years later, and they're doing a reunion tour. So, yeah.
That makes me feel old.
Scott
saying
Stapp.
Tom was my first friend on MySpace doesn't make me feel old. But hearing that, 20 years later, they're doing a reunion. If you put reunion and tour together, I'm just like, no.
I feel like for right now, it's still within understandable limits where the things that we're seeing being brought to the silver screen aren't so much things that are like the dated type of things, but they're more so because they were pretty odd events in history. And that's what I'm holding on to. Don't look at me like that, Spencer.
I'm looking at you at anything.
Just yeah. Saying
we're old now.
You know what? You can be old. I'm not old.
All right.
I'm confused.
Well, that's normal. but I don't know. Like, again, though, that you do bring up, not to negate your point, you do bring up a good point, how when we were younger and there was other movies, and I mean, you said the what was it? The Starsky and Hutch. There was also the Dukes of Hazzard one.
Yeah, that was the other one.
Not too long ago, though, they also did the Chips one.
Well, they also did 21 Jump Street.
And
recently.
Then they did Miami Vice with Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx.
Oh.
That was in the 2000s.
So really, this comes down to is Hollywood is just out of ideas.
100%.
They constantly go back.
I think you are genuinely on a
independent ideas.
I genuinely feel like that is a legitimate answer, because I mean, if you look at most movies nowadays are either based on events that have happened,
remakes, reboot,
or sequels. I mean, how many original films are out there? Like, if we look at this year alone, probably not that many.
Book of Clarence.
That was original.
No. American Fiction.
Yeah, that was based on a book, but
I think that's the problem that we have is that more big end studios do not want to take the risk on independent or original ideas. Because if they can tap into the nostalgia factor, then they can just milk that franchise for all it's worth.
Or if it's sourced on something, then they can say, well, the source material was bad. Or, you know, our adaptation wasn't as good as the book or the comic or this. Like, I
don't need another Lion King movie. Mufasa?
That is true.
Come on, man.
Do you know his backstory? Hey, Did you know he was an orphan?
The next movie we're going to get is about a seamstress who makes the magic carpet from Aladdin, okay? I'm calling it right now.
No, don't give them ideas.
That really actually does make sense.
It's
sadly.
Like they...
How did the magic carpet end up in the Cave of Wonders?
Yeah, exactly.
Who owned Genie before Aladdin got to him? Like... No.
Speaking of which, have you guys heard the conspiracy theory about Aladdin? Ooh. That Aladdin actually takes place in the future, not the past.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, so it's based upon, and I don't know, we're kind of wasting time, but now we're talking fun stuff. I need a good upper on this one because of Spencer.
How dare you?
Because he was like, oh, we're old.
I'm not wrong.
Yes, you are.
I'm old enough.
But the conspiracy is that the events of Aladdin happen actually in the far future. After the world has been destroyed and so forth, because of all the gags that the genie does that technically shouldn't exist because they haven't existed yet. Oh. So because the genie has lived for 10,000 years, according to that whole methodology of thinking, that he actually was around when like those gags were real and happening, like the Rodney Dangerfield gag and getting beat by a rug, all that kind of stuff.
And the Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I was thinking of is he's saying that he's stuck in the lamp for 10,000 years. So I'm like, is this like post Wally? Like, are we just merging everything together? Is that how it happens?
Probably.
Yay. That's
their next like multiverse movie. All of their movies smashed into one.
Pete Doctor has been around since the beginning. He's just been orchestrating this whole, and it comes full circle, baby, back to Aladdin.
As long as we get the Iron Giant in there, I'm okay.
That was Brad Bird.
Darn it. They're under the same blanket now. I don't know anymore.
And speaking of Universal blunders, let's go ahead and talk about the events that occur in this week's conversation of... Alien Romulus.
Universal blunders? Did you just call this a universal blunder? That was
no,
your
I meant
segue?
The events in it were universal blunders.
Let's talk about it. I don't know.
This film dropped just about this past week, actually. This last week. And we have all been actually itching to watch it as all of us, again, are fans of the franchise. And so we got a chance to go see it in theaters, and we got some thoughts. But before we give you those thoughts, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
A group of young space miners seeking a better life discover a derelict spaceship. As they explore its mysterious hull, they soon uncover a terrifying secret that threatens their very survival. Now, with an otherworldly peril hot on their tails, the group must fight for their lives and try to escape the Doom Station.
Directed by Fede Alvarez, the film stars Kaylee Spaney, David Johnson, Archie Renaud, Isabella Merced, Eileen Wu, Spike Fern, and posthumously Sir Ian Holm. A couple notes about the film. The release of Romulus actually overlaps with the 45th anniversary of the original film, and by extension as well, the franchise. Director Fede Alvarez explains the rule he set on Alien Romulus that, quote, if it can be done practically, it will be practical.
Great rule.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that the cast were always acting opposite a physical representation of the xenomorph. So that's actually really cool, because when you look at things like that, you want to make sure that, again, we've talked about it very much vehemently on the show, where we're big fans of practical effect work. And so when you talk about the difference of a scene where actors are acting opposite something they can see versus something that is supposed to digitally be, you know, composited into that screen, there's a huge difference. And you can see it in the eyes. You can see it actually even in the reflection of the eyes. You can see it in the reflection of the floor. It's just a whole different ball game. So good on him, Mr. Alvarez. Also, director Fede Alvarez sought out the special effects crew from Aliens, the 1986 sequel, to work on the creatures. Physical sets, practical creatures, and miniatures were used wherever possible to help ground later VFX work. which is great, because the VFX team that worked on those films are actually two idols of mine in the VFX community, Alec Gillis and Tom Woodruff Jr.
You mean the practical effects?
Practical VFX.
Okay.
So, still visual effects. Mm. But yeah, Alec Gillis, I had the opportunity to actually interview him around the time when it was after the prequel of The Thing came out. And he worked on that film doing all the practical effect work. However, the powers that be at Fox, or whoever was in charge of it, decided that after all the work they put into doing the practical effect, they removed all the practical effect work and replaced it with CG.
I remember hearing about that.
And I remember talking to him, and he was so peeved about it. He goes, we were so upset. He goes, I just was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to do my own movie. And he did his own movie called Harbinger Down, starring Lance Henriksen. And it was a practical effect masterpiece. Like, you watch it, and this movie has just so much cool stuff in it. And all of it is practical. So, you know, to see those two individuals, Tom Woodruff Jr., who has a plethora of work throughout his cinematic history in multiple sci-fi as well as horror films, to note that he and Alec both worked on this film is actually very promising. So, and last but not least, a little bit of fun information. Director Fede Alvarez used a remote control soundboard connected to the loudspeakers around the set to spook the cast during shooting. It contained various sounds of xenomorphs and alarms. I
no, thank you.
Actually appreciate this, man, because, you know. Boom, boom.
No.
Yes.
I don't know if anyone's ever going to hear that you just did like that
it will,
horn.
It will be heard. If I have to make the noise in post-production. So yeah, that brings us to our conversation. And as I said, like, this movie just dropped. However, we are going to be talking about slight spoilers. So if you are sensitive to slight spoilery information, you are warned. Spoiler alert. Let's go ahead and talk about this film. So one of the things that I think we should kind of hit off right before we even get further into our expectations and so forth is our experiences with the franchise itself. Now, Alien, the Alien franchise has been around since, I believe, 78. I don't know if our researcher slash intern. 79. So 1979, when the first Alien film dropped. So we're looking at what? It was 45 years, right?
I thought it was 40.
No, for should be 45.
Yeah, 45.
Good. You guys do good maths. I know math.
45 years since the first film. And so that's a long time for a franchise. But that's the same thing like with Star Wars, Indiana Jones, And unlike a lot of those other franchises, which, mind you, yes, the extra information, extra works from like Star Wars, like some of the TV series and so forth, although The Acolyte did just get canceled. The series, they're pretty good. Some of the films were a little interesting. I don't know if there's really been a major miss within the Alien franchise. A lot of people discredit the third one. Even David Fincher discredits his own film. I don't know if it's really that bad, though.
I think people were just upset. They're like, okay, we're starting over. We're killing everyone off.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you killed a little girl in the first 10 minutes. Like,
yeah, I was mad when it started.
I was mad.
Actually, let's go ahead and put this to start with Amy, because I think out of all of us, Amy is the most recent one to have seen as many of the films as possible, as I did put her through the gauntlet to watch 1, 2, 3, and then we saw Prometheus and Covenant.
Yes. Well, we have to start with, I saw Alien at least a year and a half, almost 2 years ago. And then after that, I ended up watching Aliens, which I really, really liked. And I really liked the first Alien. Again, this is one of those, I know that it's an amazing franchise. You have to see it. The Xenomorph. And I hit 2, and I think I talked to you, and you had said, Eddie, that there was some commotion and comeuppance about 3. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, and then you're just Alien versus Predator and Alien.
No,
like,
there's Alien Resurrection and then Alien versus Predator and then Alien versus Predator Requiem.
See, I've seen none of those 3. Yeah. So in preparation for this, I watched 3 and then I watched Prometheus and Covenant, which I liked in the flip side that it felt more like it was lore, because really when Alien came out, I was just like, oh, it's just a scary, spooky thing in space.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so it's been a wild adventure, but my brain is very, very fresh for Easter eggs and sayings and set designs and all that stuff in relation to this movie.
What about you, Spence? What was the, okay, let's start with, which Alien films have you seen?
I've actually seen most of them. The only ones I haven't seen are any of the AVP stuff.
Okay.
And Alien Covenant.
Okay. So, all right. I mean, that's pretty much just about every one of them.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and when was the last time you saw, outside of this film, that you saw an Alien film?
Oh, it was Prometheus, probably somewhat close to when it came out. I want to say maybe 13, maybe 14, somewhere around there.
Okay. Huh.
What about you?
Well, for me, I've seen all of them.
Oh, no.
On release day.
No,
even 1979's one on release day.
Yeah, you know, I just went back in time. No,
you would do that. Though.
Yeah,
like,
you could.
Like, time machine, you would do that. You'd stand in the back and be like, yeah.
You would be at the release of every cool. I know you're going to go to Nosferatu when that first thing shows up.
Jaws.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The first blockbuster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most of these I saw, so oddly enough, most of the original Alien films, so like Alien 1, 2, and 3, I originally saw them on that blessed Saturday afternoon movie on Fox.
Oh, it's not in, it wasn't in Spanish?
No, thank God.
Spencer?
That's my life. Watching things in Spanish, I don't understand.
Hola, Alien on his way. Whatever. No, a lot of them I saw on the afternoon and with the, you know, commercial breaks and then running, going to the bathroom and coming back and the movie already started and watching it. And, you know, and of course, most of the, I think, more heavier gore was removed from it because it was on TV. So edited for, you know, TV content. I actually remember going to see AVP in theaters. I remember seeing that one in theaters. That one actually was a very unique film because it was one of the first times in film that they actually successfully married the two Alien franchises into one and gave it a cohesive story. So
is Predator an Aliens franchise as well?
Predators.
No.
I know Predators are Predator. So you said the two aliens together? Are we talking just as they are alien-esque creatures?
Yeah.
Okay, what just you... making sure. My brain is all over the place right now.
Obviously. It successfully married the franchise, the Alien franchise, into the Predator franchise. If you're unfamiliar, the AVP film is essentially a story about how Earth is a hunting ground for the Predator, which has always been the case. However, in this particular situation, in this particular underground pyramid that they find, the particular hunting entity is the Xenomorphs. And so someone ends up activating this, and the Predators are then called to this planet. Actually, technically, the Predators activate it, and people make their way over there to try to find what's happening, and then they ultimately get caught in this war between the alien and the Xenomorphs, or the Predators and the Xenomorphs. And it's a pretty good story. It really is. And it's definitely one that, even though the second one gives the first one a bad name because the second one was kind of done a little bit more shoddy than the first one. The second one's overly dark. It's got bad audio, this, this, and that. The first one is definitely still a good film to watch. And yeah, from after watching AVP, I kind of dove in and started rewatching all the Alien films. I had like the collector set at one point in time. And then, of course, when the Prometheus film and Covenant film came out, I went to the theaters to go see them. So I'm fairly familiar with these particular, you know, entities. So jumping into this film, what were some of your guys' expectations with the not only the film, like the extension of the franchise with Alien Romulus, but also with the director? I want to start with Spencer.
Okay, so I kind of was like, the trailer looked okay, but the trailers lie, as is my trademark on this show. So I was kind of going in very hopeful that, like, you know, this was going to be well executed. And yeah, that's kind of all I went in with. I was like, just don't come in with anything from the past. Let's just see what they're doing on this one.
What about you, Ames? Based on your information and research you've done about Fede Alvarez, as well as the franchise thus far.
We talk about Fede Alvarez. That man likes horror, and I do not. So I was apprehensive, but I was willing to give it a shake, especially after and having recently seen Prometheus and Alien Covenant. I was interested to see where not only this was going to fit in the canon, but what kind of identity and story it was going to bring to the universe as a whole. So my expectations were intrigued, but fairly apprehensive, because no horror. More sci-fi, less horror.
I'm fairly familiar with Fede Alvarez's work. I watched most of the movies that he had done prior to this. And honestly, I'm a huge fan of the Sam Raimi classic remake where he did Evil Dead, as well as his, you know, one of his more breakout films, Don't Breathe. I didn't see the sequel, actually, but I did see the first one. And like I had mentioned to Amy, because Amy had asked, she goes, what should I come to expect?
What's his trademark? What does he do besides spookities? Please help.
And I'm like, this man builds dread like nobody else. He does a really great job of creating those moments of fear.
And tension.
And so, like, honestly, I was excited. It was a trusted director having a very beloved franchise in his hands. It was one of those things where I knew I was going to at least try to have a good time. I was hopeful. So, but let's talk right out the theaters. Let's go with Amy. Your thoughts right as soon as the lights went up and you got out of the theater.
They tried to keep the lights down.
Run out of the theater.
I know I didn't run out of the theater, but I let out a big sigh, which was very nice. Like a breath of release. I wasn't underwhelmed. I wasn't overwhelmed. I can't say I was just whelmed. That feels
rude. Sounds like what you were about.
Wow, that's like.
But also, I was literally coming down from the high of the tension. And yeah, I'm going to have to talk about it.
Spencer?
I really think this is going to make it till 50. I really feel like they did a great job with this. and like this is how you keep a franchise going, yeah, where you like introduce like even just slightly new ideas into it, and like it's well executed. It's great, fantastic, fun.
I happily agree. This was a movie that kept a lot of the same love and the same attention to detail as Ridley Scott did, as well as James Cameron did in the second one. I feel like the director, Fede Alvarez, took what was so important about the franchise and like set it to memory, like in his mind, and executed upon it. Like everything he did went through that lens, that filter of like, okay, this is what we love about the franchise. This is what we love about the film. This is what we love about, you know, the xenomorphs and so forth, and executed it through with his own hands, with his own flair. So I actually had a really great time with it, and I'm glad that it was done, and I'm glad we got a chance to see it. So diving in, speaking of like a lot of the great performance, a lot of the greatness of the film, let's talk about the performers. Specifically, let's start with the main actress, which I believe is Kaylee Spaney.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She was Rain. Yeah, who's our not Ripley, but starts transforming kind of as she moves through it. So she's the one that, like, when we first meet her, her and her brother Andy, who we'll talk about, are on a terraformed planet. They're in a mining colony, and she's up to being transferred. And then the lady just like reindentures her like straight away. And I was like, girl, this life. Like, and it's the one thing she has been like dreaming about. So I was like, well, what's she gonna do? But as an actress as a whole, not only was she was believable, but she was relatable. And she didn't wear everything on her face, but she, all the notes like you kind of needed when you're just like, don't freak out, keep everything calm. Like, she emoted really well, and I really enjoyed her.
Yeah, I have to agree. I feel like she really dug deep into that Ellen Ripley kind of persona, mm-hmm, of being almost like a young Indiana Jones, just how, what's his name, River Phoenix did in the third Indiana Jones movie. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel
that
like...
belongs in a museum. Sorry.
I feel like this particular actress dug deep into that whole well of whatever courage that Sigourney Weaver pulled from in order to personify her character in the first Alien film. I think this is a great way to continue that perseverance of women actors on the silver screen and being heroes and being, you know, the BAs that we know they are, you know, without any doubt. I feel like this particular performance from this actress is really going to be notable for future opportunities in the same genre, if not within sci-fi, at least within the more heavier aspects of film, you know, and taking her for, you know, taking her seriously. So I think she was absolutely wonderful. What about you, Spence?
Okay, we're going with the big one. I'm going to go with David Jonasson.
Yay!
Johnson.
Yeah. Johnson.
We don't know yet because I haven't heard his name pronounced, but it could be Johnson or Jonasson.
I mean, it makes more sense, Jonasson with two S's. But it's English. You can do whatever you want because it's dumb like that. Andy. So anyway, okay, he plays Andy, and Andy is my favorite robot in this movie.
Period. I think right next to Wally, I have Andy and Wally. Like, that is where we're living right now with my androids. Like, ugh.
Well, I think what makes him so interesting is that he has to play, like, in the beginning of the movie, he is very soft, like making dad jokes all the time, very likable. But then he gets an upgrade by the company, and then all of a sudden he's got like cold, logical. It's a real character flip, and then flip back. Like, it's mm-hmm. like a roller coaster mm-hmm. with this guy and his emotions, but not really emotions.
Right.
It's so interesting, and he was easily my favorite to watch in this entire movie.
I honestly was like, that's the one if I need a final girl. Sorry, Rain. I'm going with Andy. Like, also, that flip mm-hmm. with the upgrade was so distinct, mm-hmm. so separate from characters. I was like, holy smoke bombs, Batman. This is blowing everybody out of the water. Like, if he doesn't get nominations, I will write.
or at least recognize. Obviously, you know, sci-fi, you know, the two constant truths in, you know, when it comes to Hollywood is that, you know, horror and sci-fi don't ever get recognized, but
dumb.
Which is hilariously dumb. But I feel like David Johnson did an absolute phenomenal job. I have to agree with both of you. His take on not only playing the android, but also doing that flip from being almost like he has a learning deficit, which oddly enough, because he's not fully upgrading, he was found in the scrap heap. He was put together by, you know, someone who wasn't, I they don't mention like what Rain's father, you know, was outside of a minor, but he put him back together. And that equated to him having some kind of learning deficit or him having some kind of impairment, and how it was personified in the character's performance was just astounding to me. And then the flip, it gave me James McAvoy Split vibes, like easily. Like I feel like if they ever decided to do, if M. Night was really, really smart, he would do another Split film or something along those lines and incorporate this actor in some form or capacity, because I feel like everything that he did from the beginning, that character went away and we had a totally different actor in that middle part. And then, you know, the two are so distinct that it feels like two different people. So I have to give credit where credit is due. He was phenomenal.
Yeah. And I think if we're, like, hands down, he is one of the highlights for me. One of the unexpected, I didn't think I would care about her, but I actually kind of did, was is either Aileen or Eileen Wu, who played Navarro. So she's the, do we put a spoiler thing on this?
Yes. We did.
Good. She gets chest-bursted.
They show it in the trailer. Yeah.
But for her as a character, her like, she's like, no nonsense, tough as nails. Like she tries to fill that gap almost as like when you see it with the Space Marines in 2, or you see it with, who was it? Who was it in Alien?
In the first one?
Mm-hmm. That was like the no nonsense, like we're here to get this done, let's go type of.
I mean, that almost felt a little bit like the one of the engineers, the below deck guys.
The guys that aren't going to work until they get, they get their share.
Yeah.
She wasn't, I usually expect those characters to be really wooden, and she wasn't. Especially when she hit that moment of suddenly everything's broken loose. Her, you know, her friends slash possible boyfriend, they never establish it, is like getting hurt. And she's like, screw it, we're going out. We got to help these people. This is our family. She admitted that she had, when she auditioned for the movie, she had never seen any of the movies. And as soon as, after she auditioned and she got, I think she, after she got the part, she went back and watched Alien. She was like, it was the most perfect thing ever. Like, and I love it so much. And then while she was on set, because they used practical effects, apparently her and somebody else literally had a fear of the Xenomorph puppet. And I'm like, okay, this makes it better. But I liked, like, we lost her really soon. We start talking about practical effects when we get into that. I'll talk about her sequences, but she did such a great job for the short amount of time that we had her, and I liked her.
Mm-hmm. And mind you, even though, spoiler alert, her role isn't that large, the fact that she is one of the first, this is one of Fede Alvarez's first, you know, appearances of the Xenomorph, his ability to showcase it, and it isn't just a simple like chest burster that we get in this film. This harkens back to like the first Alien, where we had the immaculate and unfortunately long deceased John Hurt, who played the role for that particular film as the first person to have a chest burster come out. The way he sets this entire scene, the way this scene is just played out, only someone who has the skill and the ability like Eileen Wu could have pulled it off, to where it makes it so much more scarier in a new sense, that the fear and the dread of what we've already seen happen in other films still feels brand new in this one. I absolutely enjoyed, to, for lack of a better term, the way this scene played out and how we got things kind of kicked off with her role in it. So, anyone else you guys wanted to highlight in the film?
Spencer? Amy? Like, Spencer, do you have anybody else?
No. because a lot of them get killed. Oh, well, that's not true.
Everybody dies. Yeah. That's why we make it a tragedy.
But this one is going to be kind of a duel between Daniel Betts and Ian Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, just seeing Ian Holmes kind of back in the franchise was kind of cool.
That was really cool.
Because I was like, I know you.
And, of course, everybody looks at like, oh, my God. It's Bilbo. Like, that's the first thing everybody says. I know that's what I said. Like, it's Bilbo.
Well, we also saw the movie together. And you literally go, oh, that's Bilbo. Like that. And I'm like, what the heck? I wanted to be surprised. Let me stare.
Yeah, that was really cool, though.
Yeah, that. And yeah, I think even the as small as this cast was, they did a really good job, not only in the believability, but I think that really just kind of segues into not only Fetty's like handprint, but the practical effects, the effects team, period, well, hard stop.
And even before we get into like the practical effect work, like the story that he builds here feels very much in vain with the franchise. Mm-hmm. Like if we were talking about story building, the actors are who help create that, you know, environment. And from the speech to the mindsets, like of, you know, how people view androids and how people view life and the way it is and how the company treats its quote unquote employees, you know.
Ooh.
And
oh,
it's like,
gosh.
if ever there was a consistent running thread through all of these films, it's that the company doesn't care about you. The company cares about the company. And ultimately it's creating just the most enormous, you know, fan base of people who hate Weyland Yutani. Because in
Sorry,
this,
Guy
I
Pierce.
Mean, Amy had put it pretty on the tip of the nose when it came to when she mentioned about the woman who our main character Rain is talking to about getting off world. She goes like, I met my quota, you know, I did my hours, you know, I should be eligible. And we see from the lady's perspective, and of course it says she's eligible, but then the lady instantly is like, oh, well, we changed our quotas. Now it's double that amount, you know, and just, you know, the company appreciates your efforts and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh my gosh. But that happens today. And it's like, we're looking at it as an extension of like what's going on, you know, in the working world. And the funny thing is, and me and Amy saw this video not too long ago about kind of the nature of these types of movies, these especially during the 70s when you had a lot of movies around like the working class, the blue collar jobs, the people who were trying to make, you know, any sense of a living. The Alien movie kind of brought that into the sci-fi genre, which gave it even more of a larger platform to speak about. Because obviously, as the video so aptly put it, it's ultimately about space truckers, you know, and about how they're hauling this stuff and they got to get from one point to the next. And they, you know, they only get paid once they deliver the payload and this and that. And ultimately, it's about the company screwing them over and pretty much saying, you know, hey, you're expendable. All we care about is this really cool and new toy that's on your ship that needs to make it back home so that way we can get, you know, the new toy and play with it and dissect it and cut it up.
Which really even carries through 1, 2, and 3. But then when you start even getting to Prometheus and Covenant, you can see where it is still an underlying theme that everyone is expendable unless it is the person at the top of the company.
Not even that. Like, it shows one of the beautiful things about Prometheus that a lot of people miss is that it shows that ruthlessness, that ruthless sense of logic starts at the very beginning with the engineers. And it's very much mirrored by people today, but it is still a trait that even the engineers carry as, you know what, I know we created you and this and that, but you're not important. You're expendable, you know, kind of devaluing the whole sense of life itself. Mm. And so coming into this film with all that knowledge in hand, at the very beginning, within the first 10 minutes of the film, you immediately get that sense that like, oh yeah, we're definitely in the Alien franchise. This is definitely the company who used Bilbo to just pretty much mess over everybody on that ship and not really care and tell them, you know, the crew's expendable. Or the space marines who went to space and Paul Reiser told them they weren't important and all that was mattered was that they bring back a xenomorph. And like in the third one, when everybody in the whole penal colony was not important and they were all expendable. And even the one guy who had faith in the company ends up getting shot dead at the end of the film. So it's like he's the only person who is killed not by a xenomorph in that film. So it's true.
But Ripley in Fire.
Well, outside of that, I mean, anyway.
Sorry.
So I really have to applaud Fede Alvarez for really giving the love and care that this film needed to create the consistency for, I mean, because it's been almost 10 years or maybe a little less than that since Covenant.
2017,
are you sure?
One was 2012 and one was, or yeah, 2012 and 2017. I will check because I saw it earlier.
17, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's been about, what, 8 years?
Yeah.
No, 7, 8 years.
Which is what the distance between Alien and Aliens was, too.
No. 8 years?
It was like 7 years.
7 years.
No. From Alien and Aliens?
Yes.
From Alien to Aliens.
79 and 86.
Wait, you're talking about the release date. Yeah. Okay. I'm thinking like in-universe time.
Oh, in-universe time. No, this is...
My bad.
What was this, 20 years?
This is, so what, this particular film?
For Romulus.
So just so we understand.
Timeline.
Alien happens. When it happens, then you have 20 years, and then you have Romulus. Mm-hmm. And then from the first film to Aliens, it's 56 years. And then from the second film to the third film, I believe it's just like months. I don't know if it's that long.
Yeah.
Because they're in cryosleep at the time, or hypersleep, or whatever.
Well, cryosleep, and I think even in this one, they point out, like, it's just going to feel like one night of bad drinking, and you could be in cryosleep for insert however many years.
That's true. So let's go ahead and transition over to kind of what Amy was mentioning before all of that regarding the VFX aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You said you had some things that you wanted to bring up.
Yeah, so definitely if we're digging in, that first chest burster sequence with Eileen or
Eileen Wu.
Yeah.
I would assume it's just Eileen.
Yeah. Well, it was more, I really, and this sounds kind of weird, I appreciated more of the actual anatomy of this chest burster and the way that it came out versus like the original Alien, where it was just like, it was hole puncher style, right? It just straight up and like whack-a-mole. Which, not gonna lie,
whack-a-mole.
It was whack-a-mole.
I don't think whack-a-mole works that way.
I mean, it could, but that chest burster, I remember.
You mean like in Toy Story when they're showing that chest burster that's coming up in the game at Pizza Planet?
Yeah, just like that. This one, it was the whole cracking and the knocking and everything. Man, not, and even I'm not a body horror person, but I appreciated the way that with the entire practical effects of it opening and that it wasn't a full right in the middle, and then when the chest burst of the alien came out, it was still like in a sack and everything, and I was like, this is so weird and I like it.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's a very intentional choice to go the route that Fede Alvarez did when he presented everything that he was doing as, you know, relation to, you know, the consistency of what we've seen before. Obviously, with the first film, it was very new. It was very, you know, just ultimately state of the art at the time, especially with how they did a lot of the practical effect work in that film. The first film I'm talking about, for instance, like the appearance of the face hugger in the actual egg was actually Ridley Scott's hands in like a butterfly formation, wiggling his fingers in it.
So
that's
cool.
Literally how they got the look of it. The actual opening of the egg, you actually get some organs from like cows or whatever, like their actual organs in there. I believe they were sheep. They were sheep organs. And then
they were still organs of animals.
And then when they get the actual face hugger off of John Hurt's character and they're examining it, it's actually like oysters, it's clams, it's literally like seafood in there. That's what they're moving around. It's legitimate organic material. And that's kind of the thought process. Like you're looking at almost, as we stated, 45 years of ingenuity where we look at that nowadays and it has to be CG or it has to be overly fake or it's not even the detail may not even be present. And then you fast forward to what Fede Alvarez did in this film. And mind you, it may not be in the realm of, you know, animal organs. I'm pretty sure PETA might have an issue with that, but but you have the inclusion of making sure that the detail is there to where they make you notice the outside sack or the outside like sheath of the alien, you know, chest burster, the shedding of the chest burster, you know, and all these different elements, even which I thought was a really cool element, the recognition of the headpiece on the xenomorph going from translucent to opaque, you know, as it's almost, you know, interacting with the oxygen in the actual hole. Like you're like, oh, that's actually really cool. Like you're seeing this transform in the most minute ways, but it creates like such a more complicated and complex microcosm of a universe where there's stages of these, you know, particular monsters that we thought were just, you know, burst out and then they turned into things, you know, where we've seen like the you know, the sheddings and whatnot in certain films and so forth. But to the degree where he creates actual almost like cocoons for them is pretty mind blowing.
I think what really sells it is just like what you've been talking about is this attention to detail.
Yeah.
Because with a combination of like the sounds that like are being specifically used and like all these new details, I think that's how you bring new life to a scene like this. Mm-hmm. Because to be perfectly honest, we have seen this before.
Yeah.
And normally I'd be like, this is annoying. But this was fantastic to watch because it was just so much detail. And then also we can't forget about the actors in the scene.
Yeah.
Because like her friends just being like, I don't know what to do. It's such an honest and like relatable thing that I'm like, all of this together is just brilliant.
Yeah. I really do have to appreciate you kind of nail it on the head. These aren't space marines. These aren't space truckers. These aren't prisoners at a penal colony. Like these are legitimate just, you know, workers, miners, individuals who work on some form of Terran, like some form of, you know, of a planet and try to just eke out a living. And they're literally thrust into a situation where they are faced with probably one of the most deadly entities in their known universe or unknown universe, so to speak. And they have genuine responses. Like they have situations where people who have animosity, certain kinds of animosity towards androids presented in a certain way that seems legitimate if someone else was put into a situation like his or someone who's just a driver and has no idea of what's going on and is genuinely scared, or someone who, you know, is just so afraid of losing a family member that when that family member gets taken, they kind of lose sense of themselves and they're kind of lost in that moment. Like we see all that done by these performers in just about every instance. And it's like that kind of acting creates that connection for the audiences where, again, going back to 1979, when on the rise, you had a lot of blue collar workers who, you know, if they had money or if they, you know, if they were whatever, they go see the movie, they could create a connection. They could, you know, make that, you know, understanding that logical connection with the people on the screen. They're like, oh yeah, you know, I totally get it. Yeah. My company, you know, screws me over all the time. You know, my paychecks, blah, 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 blah. Like you create the connection. In this one, there is a connection with young people, especially with the housing markets nowadays and the way the cost of living has gone up drastically. And a lot of young families, a lot of young people, a lot of individuals who are trying to make it are willing to do some of the most drastic things to try to get to a level of comfortable living. And this is one of those situations where sometimes those bets don't always, you know, pay off. And we have a situation like this where genuine fear, genuine concern out of something so universally, that should be universally accepted, that everybody deserves a right to live. And this gives this gives a great satire, or not even satire, just metaphor of kind of the world we live in today, which goes back to, again, the genius of both Ridley Scott and Fede Alvarez. Fede Alvarez hitting it on the head, much as Ridley Scott did back then, by trying to make a connection with a lot of those individuals who just are struggling to make ends meet, to create a I almost said make a name for themselves, and almost flashback to Gambit from the last episode. But like, make a living for them and their families. This is the same thing, same issue. We're struggling with the same stuff. And Fede Alvarez just packaged it in a new and more updated, you know, box, but it's the same gift to see exactly what everybody else is struggling with.
Well, and also you have that Fede made sure that this wasn't just a love letter to the Fran. It wasn't just a standout alone piece. It fit in the canon in such a way that it was streamlined, that like the opening sequence, which I'm not going to lie, the sheer silence in the movie theater where everyone was super uncomfortable was hilarious to me. Like there were people like wrestling and moving around. But then when we get to the face hugger sequence with the insemination, because that's what it is, he had told, and again, this is, I'm going with Eileen.
Eileen Wu.
Eileen. He told her, he's like, listen, you need to time this perfectly. And there was somebody that was actually with the facehuggers, with the bladders. He goes, because everyone that's about this franchise knows exactly that you have to be in time with those bladders on the facehugger so that your breathing matches. And I thought about that when I watched that sequence, because I had never noticed. I'm like, it's, and when they're like, oh, it's keeping her alive and it's breathing for her because of those bladders, and they were going up and down, and her chest was doing exactly in time. I was like, wow, this is so weird and so neat. And then when I read about that, I was like, oh, it's not, he just cares about this franchise. He cares about this.
It's a love of the franchise. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. He actually cares about the franchise that he is creating an extension of through his own eye. You know, he absolutely sees what this franchise was made to do and what its message was, and wanted to continue that message in a way that only he could tell. And to be quite frank, he nailed it. He absolutely hit it on the head, and he carried the torch that Ridley Scott had started and James Cameron picked up and David Fincher tried to pick up and so forth and so forth. And even, you know, Ridley going back to, you know, the basis and basics and doing Prometheus and even Covenant. And you can now add Fede Alvarez to that, you know, echelon of directors who have given great stories to this franchise. And then I don't know if you guys saw, there's apparently a series coming out called Alien Earth, which I'm not too sure what it's about. I just know that they debuted the trailer when the film dropped. So yeah, that's what we were understanding. I got the hiccups. But yeah, let's kind of go into, do you guys have any highlights that you have of the film? Anything that you guys want to exemplify or even hiccups?
I've got a bit of both, actually. And this is the thing. And this was how the recovery made it even more spectacular. So as we mentioned, there are puppets through this entire thing.
Yeah.
And when we first meet Rook, or his first name's Ash, right? Yes. Ian Holm. Yeah.
In the first film, it's Ash.
But so we know him as Officer Rook. When they put him up onto the console and they plug him in, which I was like, let's get that shout out to Alien 3 and how we plug things in. When they turn him on, my initial gripe was... Well,
they technically... Hold on, not to disrupt you, but they do the same thing in the first Alien film when they bring him up and then they plug him in and all that.
But it was his actual head. So in this one with Ian Holm, we see like when they first get him online, the CGI or the overlay for the mapping for his face was really not the best that it could be. It was really disjointed. It was terrible. And then literally, I don't know, I can't remember. It's like within the next couple of scenes, we switch to the full puppet. And I'm like, full puppet. Full puppet is perfection. You don't need to go back. And then when we see him again on the screens throughout the ship, you see a little bit of the CGI, but he still looks puppety. And I'm like, that's what I want. That's what I need. And so that was my one misstep where I was like, no. But I love, I loved it. And I think Fetty also brought up the fact that of all of the androids that they've had so far are all the synthetics. Like, everybody's kind of got a double chance to go up except for Ian Holmes, Ash. And that was kind of like the surprise. We're bringing him back. And I was like, that's a good bring back. Like, if you're going to bring somebody back, bring it back. Bring it back. It's good.
Yeah, I'm also, to be perfectly honest, surprised they left that first CGI shot in. Because I was like, oh, no. They first saw it, too. But, like, once, yeah, like you said, pop out, I'm like, oh, we're great. Which, for a brief second, I was like, well, wait, why did you?
Exactly. Like, we were like, why didn't we initially just pop straight to the puppet?
Yeah, like, so weird, but like, it's fine. Puppet looks great.
And they fixed it in such a nice way. I was like, okay, this is good. And it was comfortable, and he still carried all the menace. And the puppeteering was just brilliant on that. Like, I can't, that was one of those weird highlights for me where I'm like, you started as a sketch, bro, but you pulled it out. Like, you got on it real quick. Yeah, Spencer, do you have, I have a couple more, but I want to share first.
Thank God.
Rude.
Yeah. So my highlight is, I think throughout this movie, what I liked the most is that the characters felt real and like they were actually thinking about their situation. And specifically in like a later part of the movie where they're like, hey, we're at the bottom of this station. You can't shoot the alien or all the acid will fall out and we'll be sucked into the vacuum of space. Which I'm like, oh, that's brilliant. And when she and Andy are cornered and like they're all coming at her and like they just start making dad jokes because they're like, we're about to die. And one of them was about gravity. She's like, oh, obviously. And I'm like, you're brilliant that you even put that together, that you could turn off the gravity to just shoot them and then move through space to avoid the acid. I was like, that right there is how you keep a franchise alive. Because like that is such like it's a small idea, but it's really clever.
It's a very sense of smart logic for your main characters. Because most of the time it's either dumb luck or a sense of ridiculous coincidences that coincide with your main character staying alive at the end of the scene. This is a very calculated and because this was going to be one of my my highlights. It's a very calculated and very very logical sense of you know thinking when it comes to, well, since there's been an issue with this, it's already been established. Number one, as a screenwriter, you would see like, okay, they want to make sure they bring back to full circle issues that could be turned into, you know, assistance or helps. And this was one of those things at the beginning. And I completely forgot that this was even a thing once we got like to the middle of the film, because you're like, talk like other things are happening that are kind of taking precedent. But in the beginning of the film, they have issues with, you know, the gravity and whatnot in the ship. And then to have that come back and be the kind of ace in the hole was such a smart move. And the whole scene that ensued thereafter was just so well done.
Mm-hmm. And what makes it great, though, is that it's brand new. We've never seen like someone try to avoid acid from an alien like this. And that's what this movie, like when it wants to go in a new direction, it does, and it does it well.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I 100% agree. And again, like you said, I've never really seen it in a film. I've never seen it done this well. There's always going to be someone who's like, well, you push up their nose. Well, actually, you know, if you didn't pay attention to the 1984 classic sci-fi film. Like, no. Like, I've never seen this done well in a sci-fi film. And I have to give credit to Fetty Alvarez and his team for doing that and coming up with that. Between that and the entire end sequence, everything about the ending, I absolutely loved. It was so wonderful. I loved the horror element. Amy shaking her head, but I loved the horror element.
Laughing at
I
me.
Loved the whole, like, just the twist on it. It's like,
it was grotesque. Yes, great for him.
Like, absolutely. It was exactly what you would expect if the continual scientific exploration of whatever it is that it talks about in that last, you know, last act, because I don't want to give it away because there's a lot of information in that, you know, last 30, 40 minutes.
And the hits just kept coming.
Yeah.
I was like, please stop. Please like, stop.
Yeah,
don't
once
do
you
it.
Get to a certain point in this movie, it's just like bang, 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 bang. Yeah. Let's go.
You're off the rails and you're like, where is this going? What is it? My brain was, where is this going? When is it ending? And yours is like, don't stop.
Don't stop. Keep going. This whole last 35 minutes of the film is just gold from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And I mean to end. Like, even when the last scene goes, like, everything that is happening is absolutely sci-fi horror perfection. And I just got to give, first off, whoever designed the creature elements for a lot of these films, or for a lot of these particular entities, especially for the last one, like, hats off to you for coming up with the designs that you came up with. You know, the thinking and logic that went into creating that whole final sequence, everything about it was just perfection.
Chef's kiss.
Yes, chef's freaking kiss. So, yeah, I really do applaud him, the director and his team. But that does bring us to our roundtable question of the evening, and that is,
there's one of these.
Yeah, we're actually doing one. I don't think we've done one all summer. So, question is: there are talks about Fede Alvarez taking another step into the franchise and doing an AVP remake. The question for you guys, because we could get into the weeds. Obviously, Fede Alvarez went on an interview and said that if he'd be willing to do an AVP remake, he said, I would under one stipulation. He said, I would have to co-direct it with Dan Trachtenberg, the director who did Prey.
That one I would be here for.
So he said, if I was asked to do it, I would have to do it with Dan. Which they're good friends, so that makes sense that he'd want to, you know, have somebody who has done a successful Predator film in the last 10 years, you know, kind of join sides with him. But that's for another conversation. My question here is, are there any other film franchises that you'd love to see Fede Alvarez take on? We've already seen him show the love and care within this franchise. And obviously he has, I don't think either of you have seen it, but he shows that same love and care in the first Evil Dead remake, which is very, very, like, it's different, but still the same, I guess. Like, there are elements that carry the main heart of the first film into this one, but it's still very much a Fede Alvarez film. Mm. Oh, much like how Alien Romulus is almost like an extension. It is essentially, but it's not a Ridley Scott Alien film. It's almost like you take the first Alien or Aliens film, and then you update it, and then you add that horror touch that Fede Alvarez adds. That's what they did with Evil Dead. And it is absolutely, you know, crazy. But yeah, so knowing that and knowing his love for the source material and being able to create what he creates, obviously, out of what we've seen, do you guys have any franchises or one franchise? Let's talk about one franchise that you would love to see Fede Alvarez jump in and kind of take hold and do his work. If not on the whole franchise, not remaking it, but even adding to. Let's do that. Adding to an existing franchise.
Well, part of the problem that we're running into, and I had read it briefly in an interview that he had done, was that in that last 30, 40 minutes with that twist, because under the 20th Century Fox banner, the umbrella, it's Disney. Disney was like, do we really have to do that? Like, isn't that too far? Are we pushing things out of, like, do you think people are going to like it? And the question of the pushback to any franchise, because this sounds really dumb, but the first thing I thought I would like to actually see, even though there's been like a bajillion remakes, I would like to see him do a spin on Beauty and the Beast. And it sounds weird because the original French.
You know, it doesn't just have to be a Disney franchise.
No,
okay,
no,
just making sure.
But that my brain went there because the French one in black and white has a more gothic feel. And if it's turned more horror, like an actual story, you know, if he's taking anything from a Grimm's fairy tale and you have more of that Grimm's actual existence in it, where it was supposed to scare kids from doing dumb things, it would be good. But my brain, I love Beauty and the Beast. And the funny thing is, I actually would want to see it. And I was thinking of things where I'm like, this guy scares me. And I can see this after seeing Friday the 13th. I could see that his affection is deep and abiding for horror as a whole. He knows where the genre has been. He continues to move forward, and he wants to pay not only homage but recognition to everything that's come before by creating good things. And so I'm like, what do I give the man who has like his opportunities for anything and everything? And it's just one of those places I'm like, it would be weird, but I think it would be fun and creepy, and I would watch it.
Hmm. What about you, Spence? Don't say Back to the Future.
No.
Oh.
No. Okay. Because I was thinking about this. I was like, part of me still feels like this is a good idea. Uh-huh. It was just executed poorly. And I think this man could execute it and make it like way better than it was.
Uh-huh.
Brightburn. I feel like there is still potential there as just an idea. I just feel like the original movie.
Amy's never seen Brightburn, by the way.
I'm aware of what it is.
Okay. No, I'm just saying before Spencer says anything that might be spoilery.
Oh, no. Yeah. I don't need to. I just feel like the movie that we got kind of like didn't do so well on its execution of certain ideas. And I feel like someone who is able to make a movie that makes smart decisions would execute on it very well.
Yeah.
So like Brightburn, I feel like has potential for something.
That's interesting. Cause I mean, James Gunn cut his teeth on comedic horror, like with Slither and so forth. And then from there, he kind of got his big break, obviously doing Guardians. And then I believe Brightburn was between Guardians 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then after 3, well, because ultimately he kind of was booted by Disney and then brought back in. And then he did his third one and then fully left the coop to do DC stuff. Yeah, that'd be interesting. Like, I feel like it would take more of the lighthearted elements, if there were any, out of Brightburn, and just be full on like amp up the horror by 20.
I feel like that's what it kind of needs, more horror elements.
Even though it's essentially a horror movie.
Yeah.
Interesting. I kind of went the route of existing franchises and seeing as how well he's done inserting himself into existing franchises and kind of livening up the lore of it. I would absolutely love to see his take on an installation or a segmentation, if you will, somewhere in the middle of the Terminator franchise. Like, I would love to see him come in and actually incorporate, because we know that what is the name of it? The name of the company.
Skynet.
We know that Skynet creates ruthless killers, and their robots or their warriors, however you want to call it, are essentially just without, you know, any kind of mercy. And we got a little bit of that with Robert Patrick in T2. Mm. I think the rest of them kind of that followed were a little bit more not as ruthless. I mean, I feel like Robert Patrick was the epitome of the Skynet foe when it came to the Terminator, you know, the T-1000 or the T-800, right? I think Arnold is a T-800.
Yeah, he's a T-1000. He has to be a T-1000.
No, the T-1000, I think, is what Robert Patrick was.
Yeah, I think so.
That's what I was going
to. I would love to see him do some kind of, even if it's like a side story or even a story before that goes back before Sarah Connor, where something else had to happen at some point in time. I want to see his take in a franchise that I absolutely adore. And, you know, it's kind of stated overly that a man will cry 3 times in his life. He'll cry at his wedding. He'll cry at the birth of his first child. And he'll cry at the end of T2. You know, and so...
Ridiculous.
And so I feel like having somebody like Fede Alvarez incorporate his know-how for detail and his ability to translate the message behind the film. And on top of that, I want to see how Fede Alvarez does with emotionality. I want to see how he does the connection of, you know, the T-800 or even whatever kind of new Terminator that they want to incorporate into this versus the cold-heartedness of the Skynet and what they do. Like, I would love to see just kind of a little bit more nuance. Not that he's not capable of it, but just that, you know, I want to see what else he can portray and how far he can go for some of these films. And I mean, what would be wrong with adding a little bit more of a horror element to the Terminator franchise outside of, you know, Matt Smith playing a bad guy, which was horrific.
Just on that Matt Smith train, man, it's going to be so many years.
It's so true. Years. It's true. So with that said, let's go ahead and move on over to our scoring. So let's see if the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Amy.
So this film passes. I am not, and you've consistently heard me state on the podcast, and if you know me and or meet me in real life, I'll say I am not a fan of horror. I've grown to, and I'm not going to say mildly, just deal with it, but I've grown to have a more palatable understanding and appreciation for a genre that just basically gives me heartburn and anxiety and dread, which is a goal, is dread is a goal for horror. So yes, you guys are doing great.
Absolutely.
When it comes to this movie, not only is it an homage with many, many Easter eggs and callbacks to the franchise in and of itself, it does something unique, which is Spencer has continually said it. It keeps the franchise fresh and it keeps it moving forward. It also fits in such a pocket that you could probably line it up with the rest of the franchise and actually watch it in chronological order, which would, I think, be fun if that's your game.
David Johnson.
You are a treasure. I cannot wait to see what you do next. This is, I know.
Or at least go back and see some of your previous work so that way we can catch up.
This is his first big
studio. He's had other television appearances. Yeah, I'm just saying he's had other appearances.
And he's noted that this was his first big studio film and he was very excited and I'm very excited for him. So it's only up from here, baby. This actually gets a 4.8 out of 5 for me and it's only squeaking like that 0.2 off because I don't like to be scared. And that's it.
Spencer.
Okay, yeah, this movie passes for me. When my top complaint about a movie is that they used a CGI person for one scene in a movie, you're doing something really right.
Yeah.
Because, like, honestly, besides that, I've got nothing to really complain about. This movie was fantastic. So fun to watch. And even though we've had, like, 40-plus years of Alien movies, I'm still ready for more because we have people who know what they're doing in this franchise. So for me, because I do like to be scared sometimes, it's a 5 out of 5.
There you go. I have to agree. This movie passes absolutely. Everything that Fede Alvarez did in this film is absolute perfection. And it's really difficult to say something like that about a film about, you know, something that started 45 years ago. But we are looking at a franchise that has new life breathed into it because of what Fede Alvarez did in this movie. And I, like much like Spencer said, I am absolutely, like, so amped for everything to come out of this franchise moving forward, especially if Fede Alvarez is going to be a part of it. As I stated, it passes. And I love horror movies. I love scary movies, and I don't get scared often. And that last sequence had the hairs on my arm standing up and I was feeling it. I loved every second of it. So this movie absolutely gets a 5 out of 5 for me as well. I do hope that they continue this this trend of bringing in directors who are open-minded and able to listen to the wisdom of the past and take hold of the brightness of the future and create the things that they're creating now. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out over at our website at filmlosophers.com or at filmlosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, sci-fi, horror, everything that you're looking for. Check it out over at our website, filmlosophers.com or filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out on the socials. We're at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. There you can catch all of our great hijinks and other stuff, as well as our extra content such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found way.
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane Unseen on Instagram and Instagram only. And it's a very, very lonely, lonely, slightly not updated page.
Maybe one day we'll get that Steel Magnolias review that we've been promised.
Years later.
I don't have enough juice boxes to handle that.
Yes. Also, you can catch us over at Blue Sky at The Film Philosopher's Podcast at Blue Sky. Yeah, you can also catch us wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes,
Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or a subscribe and listen in. How do you feel? Did you get a chance to see the recent Alien film? How do you feel about the franchise? Do you feel like this is a great chapter to the overall story? Let us know in the comments down below. And if you like the show, give us a like or give us a 5-star review because we've earned that.
We have.
I keep saying horror movies. Please give us a 5-star review.
That's right. And of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any other episode that we've done. This is a great show and we really do enjoy seeing wonderful directors take on projects like this and breathe new life into it and give it ultimately another chance of life in the theaters and on the silver screen. So anytime we have an opportunity to highlight directors like this, we just will take it. And this was one of those opportunities where it paid off in dividends. So we hope you get a chance to check out the film and we will talk to you next time. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.